Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, here on New Books in Eastern European Studies, New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, and New Books European today with our guest, Professor Teodora Dragostinova. Her book is The Cold War from the Margins, A Small Socialist State on the Global Cultural Scene, published by Cornell University Press, just out May 2021 and available in open access. Thanks so much, Teodora, for joining me today.
Good morning, Stephen. I'm very excited to be having this conversation with you.
So a little bit about our guest today. Teodora Dragostinova is an associate professor of history at Ohio State University, whose work focuses on nationalism, migration, global history, and Cold War culture. A native of Bulgaria, she completed her BA in history and archaeology at the University of Athens, Greece, and her PhD at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She is the author of Between Two Motherlands, Nationality and Emigration Among the Greeks in Bulgaria, 1900 to 1949, also Cornell University Press, 2011, which was shortlisted for the Joseph Rothschild Prize in Nationalism and Ethnic Studies and the Edmund Kelly Book Prize from the Modern Greek Studies Association. She is the co-editor with Yana Hashamova, Beyond Mosque, Church and State, Alternative Narratives of the Nation in the Balkans, published by Central European University Press, 2016, and the thematic cluster co-edited with Małgorzata Fidelis at the University of Illinois, Chicago, called Beyond the Iron Curtain, Eastern Europe and the Global Cold War. This was in Slavic Review in 2018. So on today to The Cold War from the Margins with Professor Dragostinova, and my first question for you is, customarily, what motivated you to write this book?
Looking back, I think I have always wanted to write this book because in many ways it's a book about my childhood. Growing up in late socialist Bulgaria, in the 1970s and the 1980s, I am a child of developed socialism. And for me, that was a way to explore the larger processes which have informed the way I shaped as an adult. So I, in fact, remember that when I had an interview with my current job, at Ohio State University back in the day, 2006, and they asked me what my second book project would be. I told them that I wanted to write this book. And then I did it. It was an open-ended project. I didn't know when I started researching this topic where exactly it will take me, but I wanted to research the historiography on late socialism, which at the time I began my work was very scarce. There were just a few people working on late socialism at that point. And I also wanted to engage with all of these exciting debates about global and transnational contacts beyond the Iron Curtain, which similarly were really up and coming during this time period that I began my work. And then as the project evolved, I expanded it even further to incorporate an even global perspective, which I'm now realizing is also rooted in my childhood on some level. Because at least one of the case studies that I am using in my book, that is the case study of Bulgaria in Nigeria, originates in the fact that as a child, my parents actually worked as specialists in Nigeria. And this is how I chose that particular case study. So just to emphasize, in some ways, this is a personal project. It is a scholarly project. There is no doubt about that. But in fact, I have always wanted to be, and vicariously have been, you know, dreaming of being also an anthropologist. And this is the closest I have come to that.
Yeah, that was my question for you, Theodora. I thought maybe you had dreamt of being an archaeologist. what was it like, I guess, you know, this is first the autobiographical dimension, growing up in the 70s and 80s in communist Bulgaria under Zhivkov? What kind of experiences did you have? And then, of course, how would you describe it to an audience that might be unfamiliar with that context?
I have very intense memories of this period when I first entered elementary school and when I continued with my education. First of all, I want to say emphatically that I had an extremely positive experience with a great education that was provided to me by world-class teachers. But at the same time, I vividly remember the ideological language of the late socialist regime, which was actively trying to shape the young generation of socialist Bulgaria and of what the regime called multifaceted personalities. So this omnipresent ideology and ideological rhetoric are really something that I have vivid memories of. I remember sitting literally in the hall of the National Palace of Culture when it was first opened and listening to speeches exalting the glories of ancient and modern Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. This is how omnipresent this propaganda was. And we'll talk later on, you know, what is a fair way to describe it? Is it propaganda? Is it culture? And what is, you know, the meaning and the slippage between these terms? But I want to emphasize that was part of the reality of late socialism. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I also want to emphasize that late socialism is many way about normal lives of normal people. And I really wanted to go beyond these narratives of victimhood that pitch Eastern Europeans and Eastern Europe as an area confined behind, you know, an iron curtain in captivity with a dull life and uninventful, lives. So I wanted to also show the rich lives that, late socialist citizens had the opportunity to participate in. So that was one of the motivations, right, to write this book. And then to add another dimension, I mean, what was life under socialism during late socialism in particularly, this feeling that the world is expanding and that you are a part of a larger world was very pronounced throughout my childhood. The international dimensions, all of these multiple contacts with agents, not only in Europe and not only in the socialist bloc, but also with the world, with the large world. That was also a very, formative element of how the citizens of late socialism experienced their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that leads me to my next question for you. You know, I'm really interested in mental maps and geography and temporal and spatial boundaries. So where and when is your Bulgaria in the book?
So the way I envisioned this book was as a series of concentric circles, which are centered on Bulgaria, because Bulgaria in my narrative is the center of the universe. So this is a pericentric approach, which centers the periphery being Bulgaria. And I begin my story with the local context within Bulgaria and then expand to include the Balkan Peninsula and the various neighbors of Socialist Bulgaria in the Balkans. Then I look at the West, and here the West, for me, I have chosen case studies from Western Europe and the United States, even though in the state socialist conception of the West, there were also other countries included in this idea of the West. But I decided to stay focused on those case studies. I'm also trying very actively to engage with the stories of emigres, because I wanted to build this narrative also, you know, the outside and inside perspectives, the local and the global constantly intertwining. So emigres were a great lens for me to engage with this interpenetration at different levels. And then I chose three case studies from the third world or the developing world. This is sort of like the global perspective. And I chose to engage specifically with India and Mexico and Nigeria, because I roughly wanted a different country from a different continent.
I love the fact that you've chosen those. I guess there could be a lot more, right? I mean, Angola, Ghana, Japan, right? What made you choose India and Mexico and profile those?
So actually, when I was doing my research, I still have a lot of material that I have to decide what I'm doing with on Argentina, because there was a large Bulgarian colony there, but I decided not to pursue it. On Canada, Japan, and Cuba. This was some other case studies that I considered. And then, of course, as far as Africa, I was playing actually with Tanzania, because I didn't want I was sort of like trying to figure out, do I want a socialist state? Do I want a non-socialist state? All of these considerations. The way I envisioned it, it was mandatory for me to engage with India and Mexico, because they have a special significance in this cultural extravaganza orchestrated by Bulgarian communist elites. Because they were a special geography of interest for the daughter of the communist leader Todor Zhivkov, Ludmila Zhivkova, who was the minister of culture beginning in 1975, and who very much shaped the international cultural agenda of small Bulgaria according to her own personal interests, which included interest in Eastern philosophies, in theosophy, in meditation, in Sanskrit, yoga. She was a vegetarian and so forth. So she shaped the cultural outreach of Bulgaria also based on the areas that she personally wanted to cultivate a contact with.
Let's talk a little bit about Lyudmila. And I understand that, you know, there's been a lot of interest in her life and her work, and maybe even books and dissertations written about her. So she seems very charismatic. She had, you know, a very good rapport with, it seems, Gandhi and Nehru and others, and traveled the world. So how do you understand her particular role, as you say, as the Minister of Culture in Bulgaria? What did she do, and how do you understand it?
So the Western press was fascinated with her. She was young. She was eccentric. She wore these peculiar outfits that did not fit the standard image of a communist princess. Sometimes the press actually called her the communist princess. But also they were fascinated by her worldly air and by her knowledge of Eastern cultures and Eastern philosophies and Sanskrit and so forth. So there is one dimension here. The way the press actually interpreted her, the Western press and Western observers, interpreted her as a sign of fresh ideas in Bulgarian culture. Now, within Bulgaria, on the other hand, I mean, she was seen definitely as different. But there was no doubt that the average Bulgarian citizen of the time, she was seen first and foremost as the daughter of the communist dictator, mm-hmm. as a sign of the nepotism of this system that promotes the children of, you know, the higher-ups and the nomenclatura at the expense of others.
Right.
So there is this, on the one hand, right, sort of like exotic image that is weirdly perpetuated in the Western opinions, but then within Bulgaria, there is a much more nuanced image, especially during the period, which curiously now under post-socialism, that aspect of her image is being forgotten, and she's often again described as this path-breaking, sometimes even dissident, which she was absolutely not. She was part of the regime, who shaped cultural policies in unexpected ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm particularly interested in that period you describe in several of your chapters between 1975, the Helsinki moment, if you will, and her death, which was tragic and I guess kind of surprising in 1981. My question for you, Theodora, I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about your chapter content, how you begin incorporating not only Zhivkova's, let's say, dedication to aesthetic education, but this Bulgarian international or transnational diplomacy. How do you see that developing? And then, you know, how did you go about researching it and laying it out in your chapters?
So when I started looking at these dynamics, I really had two lenses of analysis. One was culture, and the meaning of culture and cultural contact, and particularly transnational cultural contact, because I mostly focus on the international aspects of culture. And then the second lens, I really wanted to tease out the dynamics of the global 70s, because I considered that the time has come for historians to start, you know, considering seriously the 70s as a historical period.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So the way I envisioned, the entire book was, on the one hand, I had to provide the background information about internal developments within Bulgaria to allow people understand, you know, the origins of these dynamics. So I do have some focus on the domestic context, but the book is mostly focused on cultural outreach beyond Bulgaria, and the choices that communist elites made in shaping those contacts. So when I speak about culture, I want to emphasize that I speak about what I call official culture. Mm-hmm. There are many ways to define culture, and the way I have gone about it is to speak about the official cultural policies of the communist regime. So this is the scope. I am not doing more than that. This is the scope of the work. I think that there's much more for other scholars out there to do in terms of the reception of these policies, grassroots reactions, countercultural policies, and so forth. These are all absolutely valid topics, and overdue research they need to be researched further. But this is not what I do. So my focus is on official policy, and my focus is on international cultural contact through the lens of cultural diplomacy. Because I find particularly fruitful the framework of international historians who have studied extensively the role of cultural diplomacy. Because for me, when I'm studying culture, I'm looking at the constant overlap and interplay between notions of culture, ideology, and propaganda. Because in the conceptions of the communist regime, official culture was part of, you know, the ideological message that they were trying to shape. And often they were speaking about cultural propaganda events, giving you a very clear understanding that they were trying, again, to shape public opinions of, particular visions that they were trying to promote.
Yeah, I guess I have a follow-up question for that. I'm really intrigued by your language of showcasing, and I think in one of your phrases you have reputational purposes, which I find is, you know, very revealing about small East European countries in general, and especially like at the moment of EU enlargement. I wonder if you could tell our readers about the jubilees and the jubilee culture. So Bulgaria had a way of branding itself around the 1,300th year anniversary from the founding of the state. How did that work exactly? And who developed this mode or form of nationalism or patriotism and cultural diplomacy?
So round anniversaries are nothing new. They were used extensively throughout the communist world, really. Various celebrations of various events were omnipresent. And in fact, we see the use of such round anniversaries throughout the world. And when the Bulgarians started thinking about shaping the international cultural outreach, what is very interesting to me is, yes, they made this anniversary, this jubilee, 1,300 years since the establishment of the Bulgarian state in 681, that became the focal point of all of their activities. Because honestly, it was attractive. It allowed them to speak about universal values. Mm-hmm. It allowed them to speak about forgotten European civilizations and the role of Slavic literacy and Slavic culture in European history and European civilization. So it allowed them to basically pitch themselves as quintessential Europeans, not just some Europeans on the margins of Europe who have been forgotten. So one aspect of the message that the Bulgarians were trying to promote had to do it was basically shaped in terms of Bulgaria as one of the eldest states in Europe. In other words, the Bulgarians were trying to reclaim their European identity, to reassert themselves as an important European player, not just as the most loyal ally of the Soviet Union from times immemorial. So this is, you know, the reputational aspect of it, to show the independence of the regime, to counter Western images of Bulgaria as the model satellite. And mm-hmm. in many ways, what I found in my research is that strategy actually worked. That as time went on, yes, I mean, even though
it's very surprising.
it's surprising. Up until today, in the scholarship too, what we are seeing is that scholars continue speaking about Bulgaria as predictable, as the satellite, as the follower of the Soviet model. And there are aspects of that that are correct in military, in economic policy, in larger political frameworks. Yes, Bulgaria was following the Soviet model. There is no doubt. But when it comes to culture, and I think this is what's so attractive to me to look at culture, when it comes to culture and when it comes to ideas of self-definition and creating national and cultural narratives, the Bulgarians were really pushing against the Soviet Union and against this idea of the Russians as the premier actors in Slavic history, in Slavic civilization. Mm-hmm. And that often irritated the Soviets to the degree that in the Soviet Union, this anniversary was largely downplayed. And we have evidence that Brezhnev regularly spoke to Zhivkov about the need to tone down this nationalist narrative, something that I was not able to document in the archives myself, but I have a strong feeling that this is the case.
That was another question I had, actually. I was thinking about records of, if there are records of conversations between Brezhnev and Zhivkov, because, you know, the impression in so much of the Cold War stereotypical literature was of Zhivkov as a sort of toady, or, you know, at least most loyal after, especially 1968. I mean, are you finding on that very high level any instructions a sort of smoking gun that was given, or was it more sort of implied?
I did not look at those specific records because I decided early on that I'm not going to try and go into the Russian archives. Mm-hmm. So I did not necessarily look at those records. I have looked at some memoir literature, and I have looked at some secondary literature that shows actually the intensity of the conversations between Brezhnev and Zhivkov on a number of issues, for example, on the issue of Balkan multilateralism and, you know, Balkan regional cooperation. Yes. Žižkov and Brezhnev continuously had tensions over the Balkan politics, the Balkan policies of Bulgaria. And often Žižkov persistently explained and tried to convince Brezhnev that, you know, he is trying to convince policies of common interest, yet he also has to assert his own voice in mm-hmm. order not to be sidelined in the Balkans. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely seeing some evidence of Žižkov pushing back. I'm also seeing, it was very interesting to me, in actually foreign diplomatic records, Žižkov speaking quite openly and actually somewhat jokingly to Western diplomats about, well, the Soviet Union being in a colonial relationship with Bulgaria, because Bulgaria was getting all of its resources from the Soviet Union and selling its finished products to the Soviet Union, right? Žižkov was constantly joking that he had managed to actually turn this economic relationship to an advantage for the Bulgarian economy. And we do have evidence for that, and more scholars are showing that to be the case. In other words, the Soviet-Bulgarian eternal friendship was definitely benefiting the Žižkov regime economically and politically.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a timeline question, just shifting gears a little bit, for the global 70s. And I know you mentioned this earlier in the interview, and so much scholarship has been produced about this recently. So what is your timeline for the long 70s? I think rather than a short 70s, you know, since the oil crisis in 1973, correct me if I'm wrong, you have a long 70s, maybe from 68 to 82. So what are the moments for Bulgaria in a kind of transnational universe for the global 70s? How do you conceive of that?
So I definitely see 1968-69 as a milestone which reset the conversations about East-West contact in particular, with the beginning of the intensification of détente. And I really buy Jeremy Suri's idea of détente as a conservative reaction of elites, both in East and West, that works particularly well for, my analysis of Bulgarian, communist elites who wanted to promote détente as a way to control larger processes within society. What I'm seeing in Bulgaria beginning in 1970, after the Prague Spring and after the Bulgarian participation in the invasion of Czechoslovakia, the Žižkov regime is beginning a very systematic process, careful, but systematic process of further consolidating power and purging political opponents, including a new constitution, which defines right. the role of culture in developed socialism, which basically sets the framework for the rest of the socialist period. And so what is interesting about Bulgaria throughout the 1970s is that Bulgaria is actually relatively stable. Bulgaria does not experience the same level of economic instability or political fragility as some other Eastern European states. First of all, in terms of economics, because of the Soviet relationship, the effects of the economic crisis are really muted in Bulgaria. They become manifested a little bit later. And then in terms of politics, what you're seeing is that the regime is predominantly stable throughout the 1970s. And it only actually becomes destabilized in the mid-1980s. And for that reason, the Bulgarian communist leadership is extremely confident throughout the 1970s. So when you take this pericentric approach that I am trying to implement in this book, what you are seeing is that in the 1970s, which is supposed to be these years of doom and gloom, in fact, Bulgaria is experiencing a relative economic and political stability and definitely cultural flourishing. And then that goes beyond the standard categorizations of the 1970s as, you know, the years of diminished expectations and multiple crises. Yes, there are multiple contradictions within how all of these aspects of political, economic, cultural, social life manifested themselves in Bulgaria. Yet, what I really want to emphasize with this book is that the period that I'm studying, the period of the late 1970s, are not the beginning of the end of communism in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. Very often in the historiography, right? I mean, people start dating the beginning of the end of communism in 78, 79, 80. But they look at Poland, right?
Exactly.
They look at Czechoslovakia.
Right.
They look at the case studies we know more about. But if you look at Bulgaria, you actually see a communist regime that is confident, that has provided a level of normalcy to its population. And one of the ways this normalcy is achieved is actually through cultural policy.
And I guess, you know, there are many phrases that you have or sections in the chapters. I particularly enjoyed chapter 3, Culture as a Way of Life, where you talk about the organization of events. So, I mean, they're in the thousands. it's unbelievable how much time and I guess money, too, was invested from the mid-70s to the early 80s. So do you have any impression of the response? I mean, where these took place, I guess, between capitalist countries and ideologically, you know, communist countries as well. How are some of these events, Bulgarian cultural events, received both in the diaspora and beyond?
So again, I want to emphasize that when we're talking about events, we're talking about what the communist regime called representative events and prestigious events. So we're talking about exhibitions in famous museums, concerts, you know, photo exhibits, book readings, film screenings, and so forth. And the numbers that are reported are staggering. But I want to emphasize that there is no doubt that these numbers, and actually one statistic I came across from the Bulgarian Sociological Institute, gave the staggering number of 38,000 events in 5 years. Yes.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's no doubt that the way these events were counted, you know, that reminds us sort of like the mechanisms of how do you fulfill your cultural plan? Because these are plans, right? Plans that are set by the central authorities that the embassies have to fulfill, that the cultural institutions have to fulfill. So they literally write reports back in which they list what events they have organized and they count, you know, how many events they have organized. So there is a lot of doctoring of data here going on. So I have no doubt that some of these numbers are, you know, overemphasized. But what is important to me is, again, the geography. And the importance placed on certain areas. So as far as the West, early on, the Bulgarian regime decided that this was a priority. And then they also decided that what is going to matter there is quality, not quantity. So quantity was reserved for other areas of the world, not for the West. So they went for the best cultural institutions. They went for the British Museum. They went for the Petit Palace. They went for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. This is what they wanted. They wanted the world to see this small state as the heir of a worthy, world-renowned civilization. And they counted audiences. Supposedly in the British Museum, some 300,000 visitors saw the Bulgarian treasures. This is a vast number of visitors who came and, you know, saw these Bulgarian exhibits, who were accompanied by glossy pamphlets that were also exalting the achievements of the socialist regime. So again, here you see this overlap between culture and propaganda, because it was the reputational aspect of it to shape public opinion. Now, this is one aspect of the events. The other aspect is that the Bulgarians were definitely trying to also organize more impactful events such as meetings with, you know, progressive intellectuals and allies. So there are a number of those, and they seem to be successful. Why? Because the Bulgarians decided in most of these events in the West to ignore ideology and actually stick with universal human values. So when they went to Western institutions, to Western congresses, to meetings, they very consciously downplayed nationalism and then very consciously ignored propaganda in the actual events. In other words, in the internal rationalization of why we're going to the West with, you know, our cultural events, propaganda was omnipresent. But when actually the Bulgarians went to the West, they wanted to emphasize culture, not ideology, in the way they pitched their events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about that for India and Mexico. I mean, in chapter 5, which is titled Like a Grand World Civilization, I think you make this argument very strongly through the Paracentric perspective. And that's, you know, in fact, with the connections that Bulgarian cultural bureaucrats and technocrats and sort of culture vultures are making with India and Mexico, ideology is very problematic. I wonder if you could say something about that, the political allegiances, I mean, the dirty wars that Mexico has and so forth. I mean, is that a priority for Shevkov? Does he care about the ideological, let's say, goodwill gestures? How does that work in the 1970s? Is it just that culture has become more important than politics, period?
So we are learning more and more from the growing literature that from the 1960s on, communist elites were very willing to compromise their ideological understandings of the world for pragmatic reasons. We have various Eastern European states actually going and, you know, forging contacts and contracts with capitalist states, but also with various dictators, which went against their ideological understandings of the world. And this is very much happening in Bulgaria as well, where you have Shevkov forging these contacts with Indira Gandhi, for example, in India, during a period of severe repression that she was implementing in the late 1970s in her own country, but completely ignoring that part of the diplomatic interactions. And what was very interesting for me to see in the Bulgarian diplomatic correspondence, how a key concern was how to, and that is a quotation, resolve the contradictions in the relationship between the states.
Protivorechia, right?
Exactly,
What are the contradictions? Are they just political? Because, I mean, the alignment, I guess, with Nigeria seems very interesting. There are a lot of countries that are courting Nigeria because of the oil glut and world markets, you know, after 1973. How would you explain this sort of motive?
So something I haven't touched upon yet, and I probably should, is that also very often the motivations are also economic, because what you're seeing is a regime that is now really intent on acquiring more hard currency, with, again, making compromises with ideological positions in order to forge successful economic relationships. So at the same time as the Bulgarians were forging cultural contacts in India and Mexico, they were also building chemical plants and agro-industrial complexes and other economic enterprises in these two countries. And then at the same time, they were trying to stage culture in Nigeria in these bizarre events, which make no sense. Why would you even try to do this in Nigeria when your desire is actually, again, to forge economic relationships? Their main consideration there was to secure construction contracts for the Bulgarian construction firm, Techno Export Story, in order to be able to participate in the building of the new capital of Nigeria, Abuja, which the new federal government was building. So you see pragmatism, not ideology, dominating these relationships. And that becomes even more so in the 1980s, when ideology, and other scholars are showing this now, ideology was really put to the side.
Mm-hmm. Is it safer, Theodora, to reach out in these friendship and goodwill societies to diaspora groups or to distant countries that are not anti-communist and, let's say, not antagonistic? Because, you know, again, you've got this really fascinating part. People have to read it about New Lexington, Ohio. And, you know, there's also the emigre press, obviously, in places like Munich, not to mention dissidents like Blaga Dmitrova and so forth. So, I mean, is it a safe choice from the perspective of Zhivkov and his sort of power elite structure to reach out to distant countries like that?
It actually was in some ways a minefield, especially in the West, where you do have a vocal anti-communist emigre community. So I want to sort of like differentiate here. Where was it safe? It was really safe in India, Mexico, and Nigeria, where, you know, first of all, these are faraway places. The average Bulgarian has no way to stay informed of what's happening there. And frankly, the relationships that the Bulgarian elites are forging in these countries are often based on personal interests and personal connections between the ruling families. So those appear more as like dynastic relations, almost. And what is so interesting is in these faraway places, India, Mexico, Nigeria, but also I will add here Japan, which I chose not to research, but was also another prime destination. What you're seeing there is this exaggerated Bulgarian rhetoric of, you know, Bulgaria as a grand civilization. Because why? There's no one there to scrutinize this message and question this message. Basically, you go there, it's a tabula rasa, no one knows about you, you can say whatever you want to say. And this is exactly what the Bulgarians are doing. Now, not so much so in the Balkans or in the West, where the Bulgarians are facing continuous pushback. And they have to be very, very careful how they shape their message.
And do you see successes in this specifically East-South axis or the Bulgarian version of multilateralism proximately, I guess proximately, by which I mean in the Balkans or in Southeastern Europe? I guess, you know, a footnote to this, one of the surprises is Bulgarian-Greek relations or maybe even Bulgarian-Turkish relations. I mean, how do you see this regionally? Were there successes in this kind of multilateralist culture-centric policy that you can pick up on?
Yes, the Balkans were a big surprise to me. In my first book, I studied Bulgarian-Greek relations in the first half of the 20th century, and I knew very well that those did not go very smoothly in the first half of the 20th century. So when I actually discovered this breakthrough that Bulgaria and Greece achieved through culture in the 1970s, that was definitely a surprise to me. What became very clear is that if we take a regional perspective, rather than just think about, you know, geopolitics and the priorities of the superpowers, what we are really seeing is that at the regional level, breakthroughs are possible. But I also want to emphasize that these were not easy breakthroughs because the Bulgarians had to constantly balance. They had to perform this balancing act between Cold War positioning, between socialist and capitalist states, and then also national interests and national narratives. Because if the Bulgarians could go to Mexico and claim to be one of the greatest cultures of Slavic civilization, they could not do this going to Yugoslavia or going to Romania or going to Turkey because they would immediately get slapped out, basically.
That's a great point. Yeah. Thracian treasures, right?
I mean, exactly.
Take that to Macedonia and see what happens, right?
Exactly. Because the Bulgarians had this universal narrative of, you know, Bulgarian civilization and the Bulgarian lands. Well, these Bulgarian lands from antiquity also included territories that are currently in the borders of your neighbors. So your neighbors are watching you very closely what you're doing. And they're sending actually people to your events. They're sending people to foreign embassies. And you have to be alert and you have to be careful. And this is why actually the Bulgarians also chose to downplay somewhat nationalism, because they didn't want to be constantly explaining their nationalist narratives.
Yeah. That's a great point, Theodora. And that leads me to my big kind of historiographical question for you, which is how, you know, do graduate students and future historians begin to retell this Cold War history, not as a struggle of dissidents against a regime, but in a larger context for the 70s and beyond? And I guess to lead you, I am very interested in the mindset and the role of technical intelligentsias, not just, let's say, humanistic intelligentsias, but the role that experts play in a transnational capacity moving between countries. So, I mean, how do you then begin with your research to reconceive of grander Cold War stories and narratives?
Well, I want to make one point here that I'm hoping that other scholars will continue exploring further. Right now, there is this global turn in particularly Eastern European history that has managed successfully to actually restore the agency of Eastern European states on the global scene in a variety of geographical contexts. But so we have a growing literature on the Second World in the Third. But what I'm still seeing as a trend in the historiography is to continue to subsume all of these Eastern European states under a unitary Second World. And we actually need to look further at the Second World and to talk about the contradictions within the Second World, and particularly the tensions between the Soviet Union and its so-called satellites. So this is something that I tried to make the case of in my book, even though, again, Bulgaria is seen as this paradigmatic Soviet ally. Even with small Bulgaria, you are seeing that often Bulgarian priorities contradicted Soviet interest. And that is much more so with other Eastern European states, no doubt. So that's definitely one path that I'm hoping that the historiography will follow. But I also want to say that the global turn definitely has its allures and definitely is a very productive way to question the secondary role of Eastern Europe in the grander European narrative, right? But I think we also need to not lose our sight of the local, of the granular local details of what is happening in each regional context. And I think we need to continue complicating, you know, the multiplicity of the so-called Soviet bloc. I mean, we are seeing a tremendous difference in the way all of these different countries actually behave. There's no such thing as the Soviet bloc in the 1970s, especially if you look at the Balkans. So I would love to see more scholars take on that task of complicating that notion and undermining the notion of satellites and blocks, and actually talking about multilateralism all of these other issues.
And could you perhaps for our listeners here recommend some authors, recent books, similar work, maybe thought-provoking work? I guess I have my own ideas, but I would love to hear yours.
So probably listeners are aware of the Socialism Goes Global projects out of Exeter University. And James Mark and his team have produced a number, and I will continue to produce a number of inspiring works on the global impact of Eastern Europe in the global imagination. So definitely I wanted to make sure I mentioned that. Some recent authors I'm particularly grateful to be in conversation with, of course, includes David Engerman, who has,
book on India.
Yes, exactly. Book on India from the Soviet perspective, of course. And again, he teases out these dynamics of the Second World, which I think require further scrutiny. Of course, you cannot forget Westat and his global Cold War perspective. But Eastern European scholarship has produced really exciting work. I'm thinking about Lukasz Stanek's work on Eastern European architects in the developing world. I'm thinking about Kristin Godzi, about Bulgarian, the official Bulgarian women's organization in Africa. I'm also thinking about Viktor Petrov and his work on computing, Bulgarian computing. Again, in the global context, and he has also a chapter on India. So there is a lot of promising work out there that will continue that will continue complicating our image of Eastern Europe in the world.
Well, fabulous, Theodora. I mean, we've covered so much ground. What would you say, before I ask you about your projects that you're currently working on, is the big point of your book? Do you have a big argument in one sentence or two sentences? How would you conceptualize this along the East-South axis for others?
So if I have to do this in two sentences, I will say, first, my very short sentences is small states matter. And when you start looking at the global dynamics from the perspective of the periphery, you discover unexpected caveats that really add to our global understanding of the conflicting manifestations of modernity in this, you know, increasingly global age that we are still living in.
And what are you working on now? So book projects, research projects, everything. I know you have a lot of energy. So tell us, here at New Books Network, what you're interested in next.
So I am going to finish two smaller projects that originate in my current research. I have the records of the Bulgarian construction firm Techno Export Stroy, which was working in various places throughout North Africa, the Middle East, and also sub-equatorial Africa. So I want to write an article on this particular encounters that occurred. I'm also very much looking forward to delving in a unique family archive that I have. My parents, who lived in Nigeria for 2 years between 1977 and 1979, have preserved all their correspondence. They wrote weekly letters to their parents for 2 years. From Nigeria. And I want to do something with this family archive, which also includes photographs, slides. My father wrote his own travelogue, which was never published. And then interestingly, I wrote my own, what I quoted at the time as a teenager, 16 or 17 years old, I wrote my memoir, my memories from Nigeria,
when
I was 7 years old.
Uncensored, self-censored.
Uncensored. we shall see how much of that will see the public eye. But I want to conceptualize these materials probably through the prism of history of emotions and ego narratives and autobiographical writings. I am still thinking about it, but I'm actually looking forward to taking it in the direction of history of emotions, perhaps, because I think it captures a particular moment in late socialism through this family story. And I think it might be interesting. Of course, it also leaves me with all these questions, how much of my own family history I want to air out, and that requires some negotiations with family members. But I actually am looking forward to that.
Well, fabulous, Theodora. I will, you know, would love to read that. I love family memoirs and prosopography too. And I just have to say thank you for spending time with me and here on the New Books Network talking about your book. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Stephen. It really was a pleasure talking to you.
So I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, and our author today on New Books Network and New Books in Eastern European Studies is Professor Theodora Drugostinova. And her book is The Cold War from the Margins, A Small Socialist State, on the Global Cultural Scene. It is published by Cornell University Press in May 2021 and available open access. Thank you again to all of our listeners for joining us here on the podcast. Until next time.